Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're getting into something huge.
Yeah.
Humanity's most powerful invention, really, writing.
It really is.
We're going under the hood of the symbols we use every single day. And I promise you, you'll never look at the letter A quite the same way again after this.
It's amazing, isn't it, how something so fundamental, so everywhere, can almost be invisible. We just use it.
Exactly.
So this deep dive is centered around Andrew Robinson's fantastic book, Writing Systems, a very short introduction. He really unpacks this, you know, 5,000-year-old technology.
Right.
And he treats it not just as like ancient history, but as this living proof of our biggest cognitive leaps as humans.
And our mission today, really, is to challenge that big myth about writing. You know, the idea that the alphabet is somehow the ultimate goal, the peak evolution for all scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We want to celebrate the sheer brain power behind every writing system, from Egyptian hieroglyphs all the way to, say, modern Japanese. Prepare to have your perspective shifted. Okay, so before we jump into the scripts themselves, let's talk about the guide on this journey, Andrew Robinson. He's a British author, journalist, used to be a literary editor.
Right, and what's really key here, I think, is his viewpoint. He's not your standard technical linguist.
That's important, yeah.
His real strength comes from being this amazing storyteller.
Yeah.
He's great at intellectual detective stories, you know? He frames these really complex topics, like how a symbol evolves over centuries inside these really gripping tales of discovery.
He writes about the real heroes, doesn't he? People like Champollion, who cracked the Rosetta Stone, or Michael Ventris with Linear B.
Exactly. And he doesn't just list their findings. He makes you feel the tension, the excitement of figuring out these incredibly hard puzzles.
So it's about the human element, too.
Absolutely. He sees scripts as these artifacts of human brilliance and sheer perseverance. By focusing on the people, the decipherers, Robinson shows us that understanding writing isn't just decoding. It's about seeing the deep history, the human struggle baked into those marks on the page.
Okay, let's get into the guts of the book then. What's the main thing Robinson wants us, the non-specialists, to take away?
Well, yeah, it's partly about demystifying where scripts came from. But the main goal, I'd say, is tearing down that really common oversimplified idea.
The linear evolution thing.
Exactly. That writing just marched inevitably towards the alphabet and everything else. Hieroglyphs, Chinese characters are just sort of primitive stages or evolutionary dead ends.
And I think most of us maybe subconsciously still kind of believe that. Like if a script has thousands of characters, it must be less efficient than our 26 letters, right?
Precisely. And Robinson just completely rejects that hierarchy. He shows really clearly that writing popped up independently. Mesopotamia, Egypt, the Maya, China.
Oh, right. Separate inventions.
Totally separate. And each culture created an equally valid, equally sophisticated system, one that was perfectly suited to its own language. Chinese logography isn't some failed attempt at an alphabet. It's a brilliant solution for Chinese.
So the big takeaway then is that understanding a script is like unlocking the culture, the history, even the way people thought back then.
You got it. It shows how they structured their world.
Okay, let's kick off with a classic story. Robinson uses the Rosetta Stone decipherment. It's such a perfect way to see how these mixed systems actually work.
Oh, it's the perfect hook, because you have this one decree, right? But written in three scripts, ancient Greek, which they could read, Demotic Egyptian, which was a later cursive script, and then the famous hieroglyphic Egyptian.
And Champollion's genius was realizing the hieroglyphs weren't just pretty pictures, which was the common assumption.
Right. Everyone thought it was purely symbolic. But he zeroed in on those oval shapes, the cartouches.
Containing the names of rulers like Ptolemy and Cleopatra.
Right.
Exactly. And this was the aha moment. If those symbols spelled out a name, they had to represent sounds.
Phonetic values.
Yes. He used the Greek text, where he knew the names, to figure out the sounds for those specific hieroglyphs. But the real deep dive, the clever part, was how he used his knowledge of Coptic.
Ah, Coptic. Which was the final stage of the ancient Egyptian language, right? But written using the Greek alphabet.
You nailed it. Coptic was the bridge. It gave Champollion the sounds of later Egyptian. He could then work backwards saying, okay, if this sound in Coptic relates to this hieroglyph,
then that hieroglyph must have had the sound value way back when.
Precisely. It was this incredible mix of knowing languages, spotting patterns, historical context. Decipherment is really like a part code breaking, part history, part linguistics. It's amazing.
Okay, so decipherment reveals the structure. But what was the first big step? How did humans go from just drawing pictures to actually writing down sentences, grammar, everything?
That's the core cognitive leap Robinson talks about. First, we need his definition of true writing, which is the visible representation of speech. It has to capture the actual sounds and grammar of a language. That's what separates it from, say, cave paintings or property marks, what we call proto-writing.
So pictures that just convey an idea aren't quite writing yet.
Not true writing, no. The huge jump, the absolute game changer, was the Rebus Principle. Honestly, this might be the single most important concept in the whole history of writing.
Okay, explain the Rebus Principle. Give us a clear example.
Sure. Think in English. Imagine you want to write the abstract word belief. You can't really draw belief.
No.
But you could draw a picture of a buzzing bee and then a picture of a tree leaf. Bee leaf.
Ah, okay. The pictures stand for the sounds of the words they depict, not the objects themselves.
Exactly. The picture's original meaning is ignored. It just becomes a symbol for a sound. And that invention suddenly allowed people to write abstract concepts, names, grammatical particles, anything you could say.
That unlocked everything.
Pretty much. And this principle gives rise to the three basic kinds of signs you find in most complex scripts. First, logograms.
Signs for whole words or ideas, like the Indy symbol or maybe a Chinese character for sun.
Perfect examples. Then you have phonogram signs that represent sounds. These could be individual sounds like our alphabet letters or whole syllables like in Japanese hiragana.
Okay. Logograms for meaning, phonograms for sound. What's the third type?
Determinatives. These are really interesting.
They're the silent signs, aren't they? Why have a sign if it's silent?
Good question. They're crucial for clarity, especially in mixed systems where one sign might be readable as a logogram or a phonogram. The determinative acts like a category tag.
Ah, like a hint.
Exactly. It's often put at the end of a word, and it tells the reader, okay, this word belongs to the category of gods or places or actions done with a hand. It guides the reading and cuts down confusion.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, to see this in action, let's look at a couple of major non-alphabetic systems still going strong today. First up, Chinese.
Right, the world's oldest continuously used writing system. Amazing longevity, and it's fundamentally logographic.
And Robinson makes a big point of debunking that old picture writing myth, right? It's way more complex than simple drawings.
Oh, absolutely. That's a huge misconception. Most Chinese characters aren't simple pictograms anymore. They're actually compounds, usually made of two parts.
Okay, what are the parts?
Typically, you have the semantic radical. This gives you a hint about the meaning category. Like, the water radical appears in characters related to rivers, lakes, washing, etc.
Got it. And the other part?
That's the phonetic component. It gives you a clue, often not perfect, but a clue, about how the character is pronounced. So you need both parts working together.
Meaning clue plus sound clue.
You got it. And here's the societal genius part. This logographic system is this incredible unifying force across China.
How so?
Well, think about it. Someone in Beijing speaking Mandarin and someone in, say, Guangzhou speaking Cantonese might not understand each other's spoken language at all.
Right. Mutually unintelligible dialects, basically.
But they can both read the same newspaper, the same characters, like the character for sun, and understand the exact same meaning. That visual unity across vast linguistic differences is a massive cultural advantage. And alphabet couldn't do that.
Wow. Okay. And then there's Japanese, which is just fascinatingly complex. Robinson calls it a hybrid system.
It really is a testament to adaptation. Japanese uses three different scripts, often all in the same sentence.
Three. Okay, break that down.
So first you have kanji. These are the logographic characters they borrowed directly from Chinese, representing core meanings. Then you have hiragana, which is a curvy, flowing syllabary. Each symbol represents a whole syllable, like ka, shi, tu. It's used mainly for native Japanese grammatical bits, particles, verb endings.
Stuff kanji can't easily handle.
Exactly. Yeah. And finally, there's katakana, another syllabary, but this one is more angular. It's used primarily for foreign loan words, scientific names, sometimes for emphasis.
So kanji for meaning, hiragana for grammar, katakana for foreign words, all working together.
It's an amazing balancing act. Three scripts, interwoven, perfectly suited to the unique structure of the Japanese language, which needs both logographic roots and complex syllabic grammar.
Okay, switching gears slightly.
All right.
Let's trace our own alphabet. Most of us probably assume it started in Greece or Rome, right?
Right.
But Robinson shows its origins are much older and, geographically different.
Yeah, the journey of our alphabet is pretty wild. It didn't start in Europe at all. Its roots go back to around 1800 BCE in the Middle East.
Where specifically?
It seems to have started as a script called Proto-Sinaitic, used by Semitic-speaking workers or slaves in ancient Egypt. They basically saw the super complex Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Thousands of signs.
And they simplified things drastically. They came up with maybe 20 or so signs, borrowing Egyptian symbols, but using them in a new way. And the crucial innovation was they only wrote down the consonants.
Just consonants.
Because in Semitic languages, like their Canaanite languages or later Phoenician and Hebrew, the main meaning of a word is carried in the consonant root. The vowels often change for grammar, but the core meaning stays in the consonants. So a consonant-only script works okay.
Makes sense for those languages.
And this simplified consonant-only system was then picked up by the Phoenicians, the great sea traders of the Mediterranean.
And they spread it everywhere.
All around the sea, which is how it got to the Greeks. But the Greeks hit a snag.
What was the problem?
Greek, unlike Phoenician, relies heavily on vowels to distinguish words and grammatical forms. You can't just leave them out.
Right.
So the Greeks did something absolutely brilliant. They took some of the Phoenician consonant signs for sounds that didn't exist in Greek, like certain guttural sounds.
Those they didn't need.
Exactly. And they repurposed those now useless signs to represent vowel sounds. A, E, I, O, U. That was the moment the first true alphabet was born, a system representing both consonants and vowels individually.
And that addition of vowels made it incredibly flexible, right? Adaptable to other languages.
Hugely flexible. That's a key reason it spread so widely.
You know, thinking about all this, the first big theme that jumps out is what you said earlier. Writing is almost always a mixed system.
Yes. Robinson hammers this home.
We call ours an alphabet, but even English is stuffed with logograms. Think about it. 1, 2, 3 dollar percent at Phoneticif. These aren't phonetic signs. They stand for whole words or concepts.
Absolutely. Pure systems, purely logographic, purely syllabic, purely alphabetic, are incredibly rare in the real world. Our everyday experience shows that. It completely breaks down those neat little categories we learn.
But hang on, let me push back slightly. If the alphabet, especially with vowels, is so flexible and arguably easier to learn than, say, thousands of characters, doesn't that make it, well, kind of superior, just from a practical technological standpoint?
Ah, okay, that leads perfectly into the second theme, nonlinear evolution. Robinson tackles this head on. He'd argue superior is the wrong word. Was the alphabet adaptable? Yes, incredibly so. Its small set of signs could be mapped onto almost any language, which was huge for trade, administration, religion, conquest. Its spread was driven by social, economic, and technological factors.
So its success wasn't necessarily because it was intrinsically better at representing language.
Not necessarily better than, say, Chinese is for Chinese speakers. Logography, as we saw, offers unique advantages like cultural unity across dialects. The alphabet won out in many places due to its transferability and the historical circumstances of the cultures that used it, not because it represents some ideal endpoint of linguistic evolution. Robinson really dismantles that progress narrative.
Got it. Okay, and the third big theme, writing as a technology of power. This is fascinating. Writing wasn't invented for poetry or stories, was it?
Not at all. Its earliest uses were almost entirely administrative. It was a tool developed by the elites, the priests, the scribes, the rulers in early states like Sumeria or Egypt.
For what? Keeping track of sheep?
Pretty much. Taxes, inventories, ration lists, royal decrees, legal codes, land ownership, recording historical claims to legitimize power. Control over the written word, control over who could read and write, was absolutely central to running an early complex society. Literacy was power.
That really reframes how we think about the humble origins of writing.
Definitely. And Robinson has some really powerful ways of summing these ideas up.
Yeah, let's talk about some key takeaways, almost like quotes. The first one really defines the subject. Paraphrased, true writing is the visible representation of spoken language, mm-hmm. not merely the communication of ideas.
That's the bedrock. It draws the line. Cave paintings communicate ideas, sure, but cuneiform, hieroglyphs, alphabets, they capture the actual flow of speech, sound by sound, word by word, grammar and all. That's the difference.
Okay. The second one elevates the work of people like Champollion. Paraphrased. Every act of decipherment is more than just solving a puzzle. It is an act of resurrection.
I love that one. It highlights the profound human significance. When Champollion learned to read hieroglyphs again after 1400 years of silence, he wasn't just cracking a code. He was bringing an entire civilization's thoughts, beliefs, history back to life, giving voice to the voiceless past. It's incredibly moving, actually.
It really is. And the third one connects writing to our own minds, paraphrased.
Yeah.
Learning to read changes the brain in fundamental ways that we are only beginning to understand.
Yeah, this reminds us that writing isn't just some external tool we pick up. The act of becoming literate, of mapping these visual symbols onto language centers in our brain, it literally rewires our neural pathways. Whether you learn an alphabet or logograms, it changes how your brain processes information. It's a fundamental cognitive shift.
So bringing this incredible 5,000-year story right up to today, how does Robinson's framework help us understand communication now in the digital age? What about, say, emojis?
Ah, emojis. It's a perfect test case for his definitions.
So using Robinson's ideas, are emojis true writing?
Well, no, not really. They function mostly like logograms, symbols for concepts or objects, or maybe even proto-writing. They convey meaning, emotion, sure, but they don't have a consistent syntax or a direct systematic link to representing the sounds of spoken language. You can't reliably write a complex sentence with full grammar just using emojis.
Right. They supplement our writing. They don't replace the core system.
Exactly. They help us understand the building blocks, though. And thinking cross-culturally again, why does Chinese logography thrive in the digital age? Robinson's ideas explain it.
Because of that unifying power.
Precisely. It's not just about history, it's a practical solution today. It lets over 1 billion people share complex information science, news, literature through a single written form, even if their spoken languages differ vastly. That's a huge societal advantage, even with modern tech.
And finally, there's that element of personal inspiration, isn't there? You mentioned Michael Ventris earlier, the architect who deciphered Linear B, the ancient script from Crete.
Yeah, his story is amazing. He wasn't a professional linguist. He came at it with an architect's eye for structure, patterns, logical systems. He wasn't bound by the existing academic dogma.
So the lesson there is
that passion, a fresh perspective, maybe even a bit of productive naivety, combined with rigorous, systematic work that can crack problems that seem impossible. It's a reminder that breakthroughs can come from unexpected places, not just established experts. That applies anywhere, really.
Absolutely.
You know, if I had to pick one big takeaway from Robinson, it's that emphatic rejection of any simple hierarchy of scripts. We started there, and it's worth ending there.
Ditching the alphabet is best idea.
Completely. The real insight is appreciating the specific genius, the intellectual beauty behind every system. Each one is this incredibly elegant solution, perfectly evolved for the language and culture that created and uses it. There's no single best, just different kinds of brilliance.
Yeah, I think Robinson really succeeds in transforming how you see the written word. It stops being just this mundane tool you use every day. And it becomes this profound window into human history, culture, and even how our brains work. You end up with a much deeper appreciation for, yes, the cleverness of our own alphabet, but also the sheer diversity and ingenuity of writing systems across the globe. It's quite humbling, actually.
Oh, said.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.